As you're all aware, House Rule 10 gives the Congress of the United States, and particularly the House of Representatives, the authority to investigate anything at any time. And it is under that House rule that we are calling on the Government Oversight Committee to do the investigation. But what took place this morning when the president tweeted about our colleague, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, is grotesque. It took my breath away, and it represents the conduct of a person who is ill-equipped to be the president of the United States.
California Congresswoman Jackie Speier not pulling any punches today on Capitol Hill, calling for an investigation into President Trump and the women who have accused him of sexual assault, and defending her Senate colleague. Kirsten Gillibrand called on Trump to resign yesterday. He responded this morning on Twitter. He wrote, "Lightweight Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a total flunky for Chuck Schumer, and someone who would come to my office, quote, begging, unquote, for campaign contributions not so long ago and would do anything for them, is now in the ring fighting against Trump. Very disloyal to Bill and crooked. Used! Exclamation point. The reference there to Bill and Hillary Clinton. Gillibrand had previously said she now thinks Bill Clinton should have resigned in the wake of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Okay. Rebecca Ballhaus is covering this latest dust up for The Wall Street Journal, and she says Senator Gillibrand has responded.
So she called the president's tweet today a sexist smear. She accused the president of trying to silence her as well as the women who have accused him of sexual misconduct. She seems to be trying to make this as big of an attack against the president and his attempts to discredit the women who are accusing him as possible.
And other senators are standing up for her?
That's right. Elizabeth Warren today accused the president of trying to bully, intimidate, and slut shame Senator Gillibrand. Senator Gillibrand is one of about four Democratic senators who have so far called for the president to resign or consider resigning in the wake of these allegations of sexual misconduct, many of which were made during the 2016 election. She's the only woman in that group, and she's so far the only one that the president has targeted by name.
And has she actually taken campaign contributions from him in the past?
She has. It's a relatively minor amount. It's about $5,000 that she took from the president between 2007 and 2010. And she took another $2,000 from Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, and that was in 2014.
And do you think that she'll now return that money?
That's hard to say. She could. I mean, it's a very insignificant amount compared to how much she's raised over the years. Mm-hmm. It would certainly make sense, I think, as a political move, but it remains to be seen.
Let's talk about her and this Me Too moment. She was among the first, if not the first, to call for Al Franken to step down, which then, you know, precipitated a landslide call for him to resign, and then he did.
Yes, I think she's been on, as you say, the forefront of this this push for people to resign in the wake of allegations of sexual misconduct. Her message, as a lot of people's messages are in this movement, is to believe the women. And I think that Democrats feel that after, you know, two Democrats and another Republican congressman resigned last week, that now it's time to turn the focus more on Republicans and in particular the president.
Rebecca Ballhaus is a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a step back now. The Me Too movement has been far-reaching, from Congress to the California State Capitol, Hollywood, the media. That's progress, right? Well, maybe, but there is growing concern in some corners about a rush to judgment. Fire first, ask questions later. Just yesterday, The New Yorker fired one of its star reporters, Ryan Lizza, saying he engaged in improper sexual conduct. He's denying anything improper happened. Emily Yaffe has written extensively about the fight against campus sexual assault and how, after new guidelines were put into place, there was a backlash there. Well, in a new piece for Politico magazine, she says she fears something similar is taking place now.
I have serious concerns about what's happening. On the one hand, this could be a truly transformative moment. And thank goodness women who have felt silenced, who were intimidated, have now found a voice. And men who've done absolutely horrendous things and by their own reckoning, they have to acknowledge it, have been severely punished. That's for the best. I am concerned that part of what we're seeing, though, is very reminiscent of what happened on campuses when the Obama administration started a concerted effort to eliminate all sexual assault from campus, a very worthy goal. But where we ended up was with a system that systematically deprived young men of basic civil rights, and we do not want to go there.
And in that situation, it was a act first and then ask questions later. And I guess that was a reaction to previous decades, if you will, of not believing women at all, of erring too far on the side of, well, he said, she said, we're just going to let it slide. And so you think there was an overcorrection?
You don't solve one injustice by creating another. And unfortunately, that's what happened on campuses. And when you do that, your cause loses legitimacy. When you say, we're going to sacrifice possibly innocent individuals to a greater cause, your cause is not legitimate. So the Ryan Lizza thing gives me grave pause. We have very quickly come a long way from Harvey Weinstein. There are credible multiple accusations of rape from him. These are decades of horrifying behavior, piles of evidence. And here we have a distinguished young journalist, he's in his early 40s, whose career at The New Yorker has been very abruptly ended by, we're not given too much information, but reading the statements, clearly it was an office romance that somehow went south. He's saying he absolutely didn't do anything untoward, and The New Yorker is saying there was inappropriate sexual conduct. We don't know what it was. Was it in a private setting? So that was really fast to come to this point. He says the decision was made hastily without a proper investigation. We should all be concerned about that, because this really worthy moment, we do not want to degenerate into men and women backing into their corners at work and being fearful of each other. That will end up mostly impeding female progress, because the facts are most bosses are men. They must take interest in the careers of younger female subordinates and nurture them. That means, you know, inviting them on business trips and maybe late nights. And if men are afraid to do that and women feel, are you the next Harvey Weinstein, we're at a stalemate.
I want to follow up on that in a moment, but I want just to backtrack a little bit. And you mentioned Ryan Lizza. Would you put Al Franken in that same bucket? Because he put himself in that bucket when he resigned. He basically denied all the accusations against him, or said that he remembers them differently, and said that he wanted the ethics process to play out, and he was sure that he would have been cleared, but he had to bow to the political pressure and step down.
I think Franken, in some ways, got trapped with the rhetoric of the campuses that he was a huge advocate for. You know, what's really bothered me is the Democrats, who hold themselves out as the party of fairness and due process, have not even looked at how this played out on campus. So Franken was a big proponent. Well, he gets accused, and has actually, in his initial apologies, he said, you have to believe the women, even though he was not saying I did it. Now, there's an internal contradiction there if you say you have to believe the people who are accusing me, but I don't think I did what they said. When he was giving his resignation speech, he backed off, believed them. He said, accusations have to be taken seriously, which I totally agree with. But another deep concern of mine, coming from reporting on the campuses, is this definitional expansion. What is sexual harassment? It's anything you don't like. Then we get in real trouble, because he is denying these charges. One of them, one of the last ones, which set the female senator saying, okay, enough's enough, it's gone too far. If you read her accusation, she was a fan of his, met him, asked to have a photo taken with him. When you do that, you put your arms around each other's waists, And she said, he squeezed her waist. She later elaborated and said, I just quit smoking and gained 20 pounds, and I was very uncomfortable and uncomfortable about my weight and uncomfortable in my clothes, and there was his hand on my waist. That in no way sounds like a sexual misconduct, violation, or assault to me.
Well, she said he grabbed her flesh.
When you are standing posing, we've all done it. Yeah. You don't turn the back of your hand and rest it on someone's waist. You cup a waist, and it's kind of subjective. Did the hand squeeze? I mean, we're talking about a waist squeeze. I know that's not the only charge, but if that's what made people say he can no longer be United States Senator, I'm concerned. And again, there was a process that was starting, and if 20 women had come forward and said under oath, here are the things that he's done, and it was over many years, and at the end you would have said, this man does need to resign, and we all would have felt, okay, we know he was treated fairly, but he has to leave. Right now we're left, did he do it? Did he not do it? The plug was pulled on the process.
In your Politico piece, you quote the actress Amber Tamblyn, and she's been on this show. She's had her own Me Too moments. And she wrote in the New York Times, this is what you quote from her, the punishment for harassment is you disappear. The punishment for rape is you disappear. The punishment for masturbation in front of us is you disappear. The punishment for coercion is you disappear. Basically, she's saying, yeah, I know people are saying there's a difference between Harvey Weinstein and the Al Frankens of the world, but now is not the time to make these distinctions. We need to clear the decks. If you've been a harasser in any way, you need to go. And then we'll reevaluate and decide later whether or not you'll be, you know, let back in or rehabilitated or what have you. But right now is the time when we need to have a zero tolerance policy.
Well, I think now is exactly the time not to go too far and delegitimize this whole thing. The zero tolerance mindset has gotten us mass incarceration, mandatory minimums, a really way overdone sex offender registry. It gets us the school to prison pipeline, this highly punitive, we will not look at the circumstances of each case. If there's an accusation and anything you've done wrong, we will impose the harshest penalties, has created its own terrible set of problems. And so sexual behavior between men and women in the workplace is going to be a very large canvas. And if it's any accusation provokes the harshest penalty, I just don't think we want to go there.
What do you think is the best way forward so that this actually is a positive, transformative moment and not one that ends up being as punitive as it might be or as regressive as it could be?
I think we should look to the early civil rights movement. Men and women are going to have to work together and trust each other, kind of saying, hey, we need to create more equitable workplaces together, I think would be much better than saying, you disappear.
Emily Yaffe, contributing editor to The Atlantic, and you can read her piece on this in Politico. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Los Angeles City Council is expected to approve new fees on developers. The money would go to a fund to build affordable housing. But developers say it will stifle new building and, in so doing, drive up prices. That story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles desperately needs more affordable housing. If you've struggled to find an apartment or notice the homeless encampments all over town, that is not news. A recent study estimates that we need almost 600,000 more homes for low-income people in and around L.A. Well, tomorrow, L.A. City Council will vote on a measure to try to make a dent in that number. It's a new fee on developers, and it would fund affordable housing. Press Play reporter and producer Anna Scott is here to discuss. Hi there.
Hi.
This is called a linkage fee.
Yes.
It sounds like something that you would use in golf, but it's not.
But it's not. It's a terrible name. It sounds very boring, but it's actually a big deal because, as you said, we need a huge amount of affordable housing in the city. And right now, there's no steady source of funding to build any. So this would create one. And basically what it would do, it would charge developers of commercial and residential projects a fee per square foot. So exactly how much they'd be paying in this new fee would depend on how big their project is and also where it is and what kind of project it is. But it would be about $5 to $15 per square foot for each project. The city estimates it could generate up to $100 million a year.
Wow. So instead of forcing developers to create affordable housing, they're saying, okay, developers, you want to build? That's fine. But you need to give us a little money so that we can build affordable housing somewhere else.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly.
All right. So the developers, do they hate this?
Developers as a whole are not for it. They don't like it, nor does the business community in LA. The LA Chamber of Commerce is against it, the building industry of Southern California. And one big argument that you hear is that, hey, one of the reasons housing is unaffordable in LA is because we have a shortage of it. If you make it more expensive to build, then you're going to make the problem inadvertently worse. So to give this kind of a human face, because when we talk about developers, they're kind of these faceless people. I talked to one named Mott Smith, who used to build housing that was for LA, pretty moderately priced housing. He built for sale homes that were like $500,000, $600,000 each. And he says he actually got out of the business because the city already taxes on so many expenses when it comes to building. Here's Mott.
This linkage fee is going to charge developers money so that we all feel better as a community while stopping development and providing inadequate levels of funding to a really important social need.
So he's characterizing it just as this feel-good thing that won't do its job. And he argues that there are better ways to tax wealth and raise money for affordable housing, like maybe creating a special tax that goes into effect when you sell a really expensive home, like $1 million plus home. He thinks that would be a better way to do it. Here he is again.
We should stop trying to privatize our social safety net and make developers, who are one tiny slice of the people who benefit from the run-up in the real estate market, pay for that safety net. Not because developers shouldn't have to do it. We should all do it.
So how does he say developers should do it? Like, what should they do to contribute to affordable housing?
So he's suggesting that some kind of tax measure, something that would not exclude developers, but include everyone else too, that it shouldn't just be on the shoulders of developers, is basically the argument he's making.
Well, I imagine that affordable housing advocates are for this linkage fee.
Yes, very much so. Affordable housing advocates, developers, city leaders, our mayor is very for it. And they say this is really not so burdensome, that it will outweigh this market that we're in, that developers are still going to find ways to build. Here's Eric Arias. He's deputy director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network, which is a homeless advocacy group downtown. He says, yes, there is a housing shortage in LA, but more than that, we have a shortage of affordable homes.
And that's the whole point, right, is not to cool the market. But the market is so hot, we need to capture that right now. And so any idea that this would hinder development or be cost prohibitive, it just isn't true.
He's saying developers are still going to find a way to make a profit. And Mayor Garcetti basically makes the same argument. And he also says a lot of other cities already have this kind of fee, and they still build new housing like Boston, San Diego, San Francisco.
Well, maybe San Francisco's not the best example because it's even more unaffordable than Los Angeles.
Yeah, and I brought that up. It is even worse. And Garcetti says that San Francisco's problems are not because of this particular fee. Here he is.
The cost of housing in San Francisco is not caused by the linkage fee at all. You know, that's caused by too many jobs, paying too much money with too few housing units built. So I think people, you know, point to places where it probably would be worse without it there, as bad as it is. And certainly Los Angeles has suffered by not having that.
Excuse the cell phone, but he says basically the market's going to continue to drive construction because it's just too profitable. We have a really hot market.
Well, I wonder if economists have studied this. Do they know whether or not a linkage fee would cause housing prices to rise, or if there's a particular set point of where it, there's, you know, where it would work and where it wouldn't work?
I wish there was a definitive answer to that. All these other cities that have this fee are different kinds of case studies, so it's hard to come away from it saying, oh yes, it, you know, definitely works or it doesn't. It's not any kind of magic bullet, but the city did do its own study as part of their preparation for this, where they determined that a threshold that developers could afford, and they say that this fee is actually less than that. Now, I could go into a whole back and forth where Mott, the developer I spoke to, says that that study is self-serving and that the methods weren't really valid because of various reasons, and the city has a counterpoint to that, and I'm not going to get into the whole back and forth, but I think the takeaway is it's hard to predict exactly how well this kind of thing will work before you do it, but this is not a new idea in LA. Mayor Bradley talked about this back in the 80s, and this round, Garcetti brought this up for the first time 2 years ago. So it's been a long time in the making. City leaders are pretty unified around it. So
it looks like it's going to pass.
Yeah, I think the chances are it's going to pass tomorrow. There isn't really much opposition on the city council.
So then what happens? Where does this money go?
Actually, budgeting it in detail is a whole separate process, but we do know that a lot of it will go to affordable housing developers to build new projects, and some of it will go to preserving existing affordable housing. So that could mean the city purchasing buildings where there's cheap apartments. It could mean paying landlords to keep apartments affordable for a certain period of time, perhaps, any number of things. But actually budgeting it out will be a whole separate thing after it passes, assuming that it does.
And after it passes, when would it go into effect?
Not for about a year. There's kind of a long phase-in period where for the first 100 days or so, it wouldn't take effect. Then there's a period of time where it would take half effect, so developers would pay half the fee. And then in roughly a year, it would fully go into effect.
Anna Scott, reporter and producer for Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the best music of 2017.
This is her sort of vulnerability and admission that she just is allowing herself to lose her cool.
KSOW's Jason Bentley gives us the top music of the year as judged by our DJs. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There are only about 3 weeks left of 2017, and the KCRW DJs have made their year-end lists for the best albums and songs of the year. And to tell us about some of it, I'm joined now by our music director and host of Morning Becomes Eclectic, Jason Bentley. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
You have brought us a bunch of music, so we're just not going to play it all, just the highlights. So let's start with number one, your top pick.
I can't take over the show today, all music.
Sorry, you have your own show.
Well, 'tis the season, picking the best of 2017, and it's never easy. I mean, think about making a list yourself. It's just, it's tough narrowing it down to 10. Come
on. 10 best news stories of the year?
Yeah,
hard to do.
There's so much. But number one for us, can I reveal?
Please.
The War on Drugs, best album of the year, A Deeper Understanding. Little band from Philadelphia. It's really one guy, Adam Granduciel, and this is his... his big breakout with this album. We've been into him for a little while, but this really goes to another level. Really well produced. He is clearly meticulous in his process as an engineer, playing most of the instruments as the producer, and he's done a great job.
Okay, let's hear a track from that album. This one's called Up All Night.
But I just stopped dreaming. I'm stepping out into the world.
Amazing, he does it all. It's such a rich sound.
It is a rich sound. You know, also it harkens back to that sweet spot of 80s heartland rock when things got synthy and electronic, like Bruce Springsteen,
John Cougar, Mellencamp
maybe
situation.
You know, Tom Petty,
yeah,
Dire Straits.
Right.
He really carries the torch for that sort of comfort food in music.
Okay, and pause to remember Tom Petty.
Yes.
Died this year. All right. So looking at our DJ list, because there's the list for KCRW, then there are the individual lists that the DJs compiled of their top 10. And there are some of them are a lot different.
Yeah. We, you know, try and manage the signal to noise ratio there and have that clear signal with an overall top 10. And then we also showcase the best song of the year and best new artist. And then as a complement to that, each individual DJ has their top tens as well.
All right, so let's hear one song from Ann Litt and Jeremy Soule. They both picked this record by Gabriel Garzon Montano. Let's hear something from that album. It's called Crawl.
Bite you right through.
Tell us about him.
It makes me think Prince. Has a very Prince-like quality to it. This guy's out of Brooklyn. He's just such an artist. He really stole our hearts. We showcased him at South by Southwest at our annual trip to Austin, Texas. And then he also played our summer concert series at the Annenberg Space for Photography. He opened for Miguel on the first concert of three this past summer. So it's really sort of this example of the relationship we have with developing artists, and it just continues with him being featured on our top tens.
Another guy that seems to have captured the hearts of many DJs, a guy named King Krewel. Chris DeRitas, Mario Cotto, Dan Wilcox, and Matthew Schreier all picked this album that was as their favorite.
It's just he's doing something different, something really unique. There's nothing quite like King Krewel. Young guy out of an art school in London. His name is Archie Marshall.
That's such a British name.
And he is just completely doing his own thing. It's kind of a fusion of like hip-hop and ska and punk attitude. It just feels fresh.
Here is Biscuit Town.
Your shallow waters, I'm the deep sea bed, and I'm the reason you flow. I got my moons wrapped around my head, and Jupiter knows, whilst you orbit with some stupid hoes. Only a slacker would know. Tryna get up and group home. Tryna eat from the same bowl. With my troop is a boat, she's like, I seem to sink low up.
Cruel with Biscuit Town. Yeah.
Little Tom Waitsy a little bit.
There's a lot going on in there.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, interesting artist.
All right. Another of your favorites this year was Dan Auerbach's solo record called Waiting on a Song. Tell us about that one.
Well, Dan Auerbach, best known as one half of the Black Keys. Mm-hmm. This is his second solo album, and he assembled a cast of veteran musicians, mostly session players, in Nashville, where Dan has a studio called Easy Eye Sound. And so he got all these veterans together and just crafted a bunch of great music. They did a ton of recordings, and it just is, you know, it's just some classic American rock, you know, Americana, from one of the finest producers and songwriters of our time.
You only got a couple miles to go. Trying to drive me insane. I saw you crack a smile about a week ago in the middle of the pouring rain. Climbing cliffs of Dover to go dry out in the sun. I'm like a four-leaf clover, cause I hide from everyone. Shine on me. Shine on me. Shine.
Dan Auerbach, Shine On Me, and this is his second solo album. Why is he going solo and not working with his Black Keys partner?
They're doing everything. You know, he does a little solo stuff. He produces many other artists as well. He's produced for Ray LaMontagne and worked with a side project he calls The Arcs. So he's just incredibly prolific.
Okay. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with KCRW DJ and music director Jason Bentley about the best music of 2017 as selected by the KCRW DJs. Another favorite in this radio station, Chicano Batman. And
who you have hung out with.
Yeah. And they're great. I just love them.
Yeah.
That would be number one for me. I love this album, Freedom is Free. So let's hear a little bit. Friendship is a small boat in a storm.
You've got an open heart, so you share what's inside, thinking that all is said in confidence, but then you realize.
Not like that.
It's funky. Yeah. Has that soulful kind of Daptone sound to it. Also, just a local band. I'm really excited for their continued success. And I will say, I went to see them play at Coachella earlier this year, and they were really the only band that was saying something, you know, socially relevant throughout their performance. They would just, you know, talk to the audience. And when you think about the festival environment, and the history of festivals, Woodstock and everything, it's very much about consciousness. It's about youth awareness and coming together and a movement and what can we do to change the world, right? And really, they were the only ones who had a message of the, how many bands are at Coachella? Hundreds of bands. And really, Chicano Batman, they were the only guys who were saying something.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. So good for them.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. We've been talking about top 10 albums. There's also a top 10 list of songs for the year. And tell us about the song that was number one on that list.
Number one, by actually a long shot, was a young woman by the name of Amber Mark. And the song is Lose My Cool. Now, she, her mother passed away. And this album is very much about processing that, dealing with that. And so this is her sort of vulnerability and admission that she just is allowing herself to lose her cool. But at the same time, I feel like that message could resonate on other levels for us dealing with a year that's been really chaotic.
Hot, and shall we say?
Yeah. So, and she's a really promising up-and-coming artist. She's also based in New York, Amber Mark.
Amber Mark with Lose My Cool, KCRW's number one song of the year. Also, you have a Best New Artist category, so tell us who won that one.
His name is Tom Misch. He's out of London, and he just does a great fusion of jazz and electronic. He's a terrific guitarist, and it just feels exciting from everything that we've heard so far. He has yet to really release his proper debut album, so we're really ahead of the curve here. But I think everyone's just super excited about this guy, and more to come for Tom Misch.
Tom Misch, and here is his track, South of the River.
Watching the sunshine lace the gray, I don't know why you wouldn't stay. You should come south of the river, where the loving is gold.
List we got here. It's like funky, soulful, worldly, sophisticated. I like it.
Everything KCRW is or aspires to be and achieves.
We're trying.
All right. That was South of the River by KCRW's pick for new artist, best new artist of 2017. Jason Bentley, thank you for stopping by and sharing this list with us.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Jason Bentley, KCRW DJ and music director. And you can find all the DJs lists and listen to the songs at KCRW.com. Coming up, December is when the diet goes out the window. We'll tell you where to indulge your sweet tooth in LA, from jelly donuts for Hanukkah to eggnog for Christmas. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. December, it's the month when any lingering self-control you may have managed to hold on to lately is just out the window, because no one can say no to all the holiday cookies, the candies, the festive treats that just seem to appear everywhere all the time, begging to be eaten. Catherine Spires is here to tell us where to find the most decadent of December desserts. She is host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, when we think of dessert, we obviously think of the big holidays, right?
Sure.
So let's begin with one of the bigger ones, at least when it comes to food, not necessarily in terms of religious significance, Hanukkah.
Yes, absolutely. You have to have a lot of fried foods during Hanukkah because of the oil symbolism of the holiday. And the most popular is the sufganiyat, which is the, let's say, Hanukkah donut.
The jelly donut.
Yeah, usually jelly filled, usually rolled in sugar. Mm. It's an old tradition that when it first started, it was just two pieces of fried bread with jelly smashed in the middle of it. Now it's very purposefully a dessert.
And where did it come from? Why a donut of all things?
Just because they figured out that if they made it a sweet treat, it was better than just plain bread with jam on it. They were going to deep fry it. Might as well add some sugar to it, right?
Right. Why not? Yeah. Why not? So where do you get the best jelly donuts, and do they have to be kosher?
Well, that's everyone's personal preference. If you want to have a kosher Hanukkah donut, then you should go to Unique Pastry in Tarzana. They've been doing it for years, and people love them and say that they're the best of all the kosher sufganiyat. Now, if all you're looking for is sufganiyat in general, and you do not need for it to be kosher, I would recommend going to Artelis Patisserie, and that is on Sautelle. And they do Nutella-filled beignet. Why Yum. Wouldn't you want that? Yeah.
Do beignet count?
I'm saying yes. Yes, in our secular times, yes. That was actually also recommended by a Twitter user named Hungry Drunk. And I feel like he knows what he's talking about.
Really? Okay. Let's move on to Christmas desserts. And you have, well, of course, you've got the fruitcake.
You've got the fruitcake.
It's not exactly a donut.
No, it's oftentimes made fun of, sometimes rightfully so. People get really up in arms about whether or not fruitcake is good. And sometimes they're talking about two different things. There's the kind of cake that's very moist and dense and is mostly just nuts and fruits packed in really close. That's essentially been around since Roman times. If you like that kind, Valerie Confections, which has a couple locations around town, they make that. You can even order it online. And that's a good representative of that style. If you're talking the more Southern European, like an Italian panettone version, Republique in West Hollywood has one of the best pastry chefs in Los Angeles working there, Margarita Mansky. And she does a Christmas panettone that's brioche style. It has citrus peels, raisins, almonds. She glazes it with a chocolate glaze. Very good. Now, they're huge, but here's the secret about panettone. Mm-hmm. They're actually really good French toast. Because you want to use slightly stale bread for French toast. So if you don't finish it all, you can. That's okay. You'll be able to repurpose it for the most delicious French toast you've probably ever had.
That sounds delicious. All right. So the other big holiday, or at least European holiday dessert, is Bûche de Noël.
Yeah.
Which is French.
That is French.
It's French for a log.
Yep. Mm-hmm. A Christmas log. And, you know, trees and branches have been symbols of Christmas and, you know, pagan winter solstice holidays since before the medieval Europe in Western Europe. Leave it to the French to turn it into a delicious dessert. It's a rolled cake, essentially. It's just sponge cake. You layer it with buttercream. You roll it. You decorate it to look like a log in maybe a wintry scene.
Mm-hmm. Put a little holly, little marzipan action.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple different varieties that you can get of that this year. King's Hawaiian, which is based out of Torrance, they do the classic chocolate with a cappuccino filling because sometimes coffee is part of it. That's traditionalists will accept that. But this new bakery in Silver Lake called Frankie Lucy, they're doing an ube Bûche de Noël. Ube being that purple yam that is so often used in Filipino desserts. So what's cool about that is that it's a bright purple color, and purple isn't a color that you normally see on the Christmas dessert table. So I think that would be a fun way to mix it up a little bit.
A purple Bûche de Noël?
Absolutely. And with a white coconut frosting. That's right. It should be noted that Baskin-Robbins also does a ice cream Yule log cake.
Okay. I'm just going to stop you right there.
All right. Fair enough.
We have to draw the line somewhere. All right. Tamales. Sweet tamales. Obviously, this is a Mexican tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Delicious.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Where to get the best ones if you're not making them yourself?
So if you aren't having a tamalada, which is a tamale making party, you can go to King Taco. They've got locations all over. They do a sugar pineapple one. And you'll find that a lot of sweet tamales have pineapple filling in them. That's a popular choice. La Mascota Bakery in Boyle Heights, they do a pineapple. Tamales Liliana's, two locations on the east side, they do pineapple with raisins. And then they also have a strawberry version. And if you go to Mama's International Tamales in MacArthur Park, you'll want to call ahead, but they do a guava cheese tamale. Mm. And if you've been to any of the Cuban bakeries around town, you know that guava cheese is the way to go for anything.
Delicious.
Yes.
All right. And then no holiday season is complete without eggnog.
Absolutely. And in LA, we're lucky because we have a wonderful rendition of eggnog that's made in Montebello every year. Brugere's.
In the glass bottle.
Yeah, the famous glass bottle.
With the little smiling cow on
it. That's right. Year round, they do milk and chocolate milk, but in December, they start doing their eggnog as well.
What's the calorie count on that?
I don't even want to imagine. The reason it's so good is because it has milk and cream in it, in addition to the sugar and the nutmeg. They don't add the booze themselves. They leave that up to you. But it's an excellent choice to do it that way.
Catherine Spires is host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Christian.
Yes.
Is here. Christian Bordahl is here.
Hello there.
With some listener feedback. Hello.
So I was wondering, Madeline, like, does your family have a sort of Christmas tradition in terms of those sorts of Christmas desserts?
Oh, yes. Well, my mother's British, and so she, well, let's just say she indulged in her once-a-year passion, which is Christmas pudding.
That's so
which
funny.
For us
my,
was
I
disgusting.
Have an English grandmother who also insisted on having Christmas pudding every Christmas. And yeah, it's terrible. My grandfather would put the rum on it and we'd light it on fire and bring it out. All the kids hate it.
For those who are not in the know, the color is a bit off-putting.
It's like sludge.
Black sludge. And it's just not too tasty.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's emotional. It's an emotional bond to the old country for her. So we indulge.
My favorite was a thing called kransekake.
Of
which
course.
Is a Norwegian weird thing that's like little concentric circles that get smaller and smaller on top of each other. It's made of almonds and it's like little cookies but with a really soft inside.
That
it's
sounds
really,
delicious.
Really, it really is really good. Yeah. Yeah. I also asked some of our producers what their favorite music was of 2017. Michelle said she liked the SZA album and Natalia Lafourcade. Sarah likes Run for the Jewels 3 and Kendrick Lamar. Quinn liked the Kurt Vile album, the one he did with Courtney Barnett. What about you, Madeline?
Well, I'm going to take a page from one of my kids who's obsessed with Princess Nokia.
Ah.
So shout out to Princess Nokia.
Okay.
And check out her music online.
All right,
it's
I haven't
really
listened
good.
To that.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of Elbow, so I saw them when they were in town recently, and they had a new album out this year that was really good, I liked.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your recommendations, staff of Press Play. We'd love to hear yours, too. You can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.